This is the podcast of the German Historical Institute London, a research centre dedicated to supporting and connecting students and scholars from Britain and Germany. The podcast series presents current research in British, German and European history, as well as colonial and global history. For more information on the German Historical Institute London, future events, the GHIL Library, studentships and more podcast episodes, please visit our website at ghil.ac.uk.
Money doesn't stink, or so the famous phrase goes. So what did peasants in the Middle Ages mean when they complained about bad coin? Can a focus on monetary issues shed new light on the peasant war? In this GHIL podcast interview, research fellow for medieval history Markus Mehr and PR officer Kim Koenig are joined by Philip Rössner, professor of early modern history at the University of Manchester, to talk about the research behind his lecture on peasants, wars and evil coins towards the monetary turn in explaining the revolution of 1525. Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us on our podcast today. We are talking to Philip Rössner about his research behind his lecture about money and the revolution before the peasant war, or leading up to the peasant war. Lots about evil and good coin. And we're very pleased to have you on our podcast today. Jumping right in, I was going to ask you if you could just tell us a bit more about your lecture, the research and the project behind it.
Right. Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure. The research on money and evil coins started fairly early. It was about possibly 15 years ago when I was asked to complete a habilitation, which is a very sort of ancient initiation ritual in the German-speaking world, academic world. And someone just asked me, why is it that in about like every fourth or fifth complaint from the German peasant war, people were complaining about bad coins or evil coins? And that was simply something people hadn't looked at, completely overlooked, completely missed. So I had to start from scratch and develop a story from scratch, going through peasant complaints in the 1400s, later 1400s, early 1500s. I tried to make sense and connecting their caveats about coins with the bigger issues of the day, which were complaints about an encroachment of the feudal lords on the peasant commons, on the peasant economy, and all the rest of it, which had been well studied and well understood since the 1970s. We've had an excellent understanding about the materialist economic conditions and foundations of peasant uprisings and conditions for social unrest, but coins and currency have been completely left out. So I had to completely start from scratch, go through old peasant complaints, documents, and, well, trying to find out what peasants really meant when they were complaining about bad or evil coins.
And what do they mean when they complain about that?
They can mean quite a lot. So if you are in the Reformation, and which is the sort of early 1520s, the Reformation has just started, evil obviously always has a sociological dimension. It's like good versus evil. I mean, these are the big discourses of the Reformation. And the Reformers obviously accused the Catholic Church of being the Antichrist, or the Pope of being the Antichrist. So at that time, the word evil, the German word böse, which is a German word even nowadays, had that fundamental connotation. But it had other connotations as well, particularly if you go down to monetary matters. Yes, those coins that were decried as evil actually were perceived to be evil because they did a lot of economic harm to the peasants. These were coins that were debased, small change coins, coins of unreliable value, or at least of a value and purchasing power that the peasants could not always determine, or purchasing power that was contested in the marketplace. So for instance, if you had like white pennies, for instance, in southern Germany, and they would at the official exchange rate exchange a 24 white pennies against the gulden or the gold florin, sometimes authorities, tax collectors, the people that the peasants would encounter in the marketplace, occasionally would refuse accepting their coins at the official exchange value and often ask for more. And I was then kind of trying to find out about the exact mechanisms, what made authorities, tax collectors, people ask for more than was often warranted on the basis of the official exchange rate for coins. Now, you kind of need to consider at that time the currency works not quite the same as it works nowadays. We've got hundreds of different currencies, hundreds of different types of pennies, old and new, regional. We you've got several different, about 500 places in the Holy Roman Empire around 1500 where coins were actually minted. It's like literally every sovereign state or authority usually had the right to make money. And all these coins, they all float around, and people had to make sense of these coins. And depending upon, there was an old coin or an unreliable coin, and often authorities forged coins or produced underweight coins, debased coins. And these entered the currency flow also. So the peasants were faced with a staggering variety of different coins, which often did not circulate or not at least accepted by the authorities at their official rates. And that made these coins evil. And they would call these coins evil, böse. But this had a slightly different, this had not necessarily a sociological element. Without doubt, it often would have. But böse in a simply business accounting terms or business accounting sense in the early 16th century simply also means to be written off. So bad debts, böse Schulden, as they're called in contemporary documents, are always named böse, the same word that in other contexts would denote evil. And so there's a sort of double sense of the word, which I think the peasants were quite aware of, and they would have used deliberately that terminology in order to bring home their points when they were complaining to their authorities about the sheer variety, ubiquity of bad coins, irreliable coins, unstable coins.
Thank you. That's really interesting. And you've been saying that you've been dealing with this topic for a while now, and I was wondering how it fits into your wider research that you're conducting at the moment.
Well, yes, initially that's a good question. I'm trying to find that out myself still. But initially it was part of a larger study on social unrest and the origins of the Reformation, peasant unrest, currency matters, currency policy I studied in depth, the monetary policy in central Germany, in particular the Saxon lands, trying to make sense of silver supply, silver output, the structure of the economy at that time, and how it interacted with monetary matters. And then on top of that, why is it that monetary matters so often gave rise to social unrest? As I moved away from that and literally left the topic untouched for the last 10, 12 years, I've been coming back to that thinking recently, how does this story relate not only to the Reformation, but also to the story about early modern capitalism, early capitalism, commercial capitalism, which, as we know, around the Reformation was a big thing. It was a big thing on the agenda, on the imperial agenda. People complained a lot about big business, the big sort of merchant companies in Augsburg and Nuremberg. Think the Fugger, think the Welser, the Höchstädter. These were the topic of the day, the talk of the town, their business practices, monopoly practices, the increasingly global trade flows and silver outflows, payments, the spice trades that were in the hands of these upper German high financiers. And I was wondering how to connect that story with the story of commercial capitalism and the capitalist transformations that were going on, or in fact had been going on for a long time. There's a huge debate in the literature to what extent capitalism would have been on the rise in the early 1500s. Think of Tawney's thesis and others, and Max Weber on the origins of capitalism. But if you look at it, it had been there for a long time, at least in Upper Germany and the mining regions. And so I tried to get a sense of how these monetary matters, peasant complaints, peasant unrest, address these matters of capitalist transformation and capitalist development. And last but not least, I also think this is an ongoing project. I've started this at about the same time when writing the Habilitation. But what we miss is a political economy of money, sort of a groundwork study that studies how people used money and the way they used money and the role that money played in their daily lives, but also in politics. And that is something I'm trying also to conceptualize at the moment. And obviously, the study in the paper I gave on the peasant war and money is a part of that, because in order to understand money and what made money evil and what made certain coins evil, you obviously need to understand how people handle coins in the day-to-day context in the peasant economy. So that's the third sort of angle point, which I think that that work could give rise to, and that is a political economy of money of the common man and his wife in the Reformation era.
Hey, you've just suggested and alluded to in the lecture as well that you think a monetary turn would be a very useful thing for scholars to perform to understand, in this case, Reformation society better. But do you think that a monetary term would also be useful in other eras and our understanding of other eras, maybe even the present?
Absolutely. I mean, money has been since it's been invented. And of course, there's a controversy to what extent money was invented by private actors or was it invented by the state in order to charge tax and take something away from the people, has always been fundamentally at the heart of the social process. And that is quite independent which societies you look upon, but all societies that have been using money. And in Western Europe, or Europe as such, money has been used since the 7th century before Christ. Well, not all parts of Europe, but most parts of Europe. And since then, money was always at the heart of the social process. It was always at the center of politics, of political discourse, of political negotiations, but also of systems and modes of production. And that doesn't mean that these societies had always been market societies, but many societies where the market wasn't even fundamental in organizing resources and organizing exchange would usually have some form of money. And that money would have several meanings and functions depending upon context of payment. So I forgot which scholar that was, but there was a monetary historian or economist that said, literally, if you want to understand a society, look at its money and look at the way they organize money. And of course, I think that holds for the Middle Ages in the same way as for the late medieval peasant uprising, the Reformation, and also later on. Wherever we have markets and wherever we have money, they tell us something fundamental about how people organize society and about the politics that apply.
So it's not that your suggested monetary term is supposed to be a counter program to the cultural term, but it sounds more like it's trying to integrate culture, economics, and politics.
Absolutely. I mean, this is not meant to be exclusive, and it's possibly formulated in a pointed way because so many different turns have been suggested by historians over the past 40 years or so. And rather than this being just another turn of these turns, I absolutely agree. And you can't obviously understand, and I think my work brought that out, especially the work on the Reformation. You can't look at money in an isolated way by just applying monetary theory or economic theory. You need to look at the wider context of markets, how people organize exchange, how the mode of production works on the ground. And that, by definition, means you need to consider legal aspects, social aspects. How do people organize village peasant production? What are the property rights? What sort of people can interfere with a peasant economy? What sort of people are entitled to take something away from the peasant? Just speaking about peasant, because until the Industrial Revolution, peasant farmers, depending on where you are, account for up to 70 or 80% of the population. So they are the most important sort of contributors to gross domestic product and output. So again, to just look at money, as many economic historians do, by just considering economic theory and monetary theory is dangerous because it doesn't explain everything, perhaps not even a lot. I mean, because money is a total social phenomenon in a sense, you need to look at it from a sociologic point of view, anthropologic point, and the cultural context as well. And in the same way, I think a monetary turn would link back into broader issues of cultural, social, sociological, and anthropological nature. This is just one building block within a bigger sort of house that would sort of explain in terms of materialist factors how, in that particular case, the Reformation unfolded.
As people live through a cost of living crisis and certainly feel that their money is worth less, hearing about peasants realizing that debased money affects them negatively and is for that reason evil money, you might want to think that maybe reinforcing money would be a good solution. But medieval and early modern people also made negative experiences with reinforcing currencies, did they not?
They did. And that's one of the perennial questions that a longer-term politic economy would have to sort out, about the different scenarios in which certain people gain and certain people lose from the deal. And that was a big literature in the casuistic literature about how to honor payments on contracts. I mean, how to fulfill contracts with which currency, and what happens if the currency is being reinforced? Does this mean that I have to pay more, or which currency can I use instead? And obviously, this is context dependent. So the peasants may have been negatively affected by a reinforcement of the currency, but they obviously thought, given the scenario, they were more affected by the bad coins. And again, this is something that you find occasionally in the monetary history literature, but to my knowledge, it hasn't been explored systematically, and something that would deserve of a larger scale, more long-term, long-durée study, really think what happens to different social actors, not only peasant farmers. And peasant or villages, people living on the countryside, are massively different. You have the larger farmers who are doing quite well, then you have the landless people, the landless cottars, the inn servants, the tenants, you have the taverners, the innkeepers. So there's an enormous variety of people, even on the countryside, not to speak of the cities and towns, who are all, in a sense, differently affected by bad money or reinforcement, and will all have occasionally different interests in the marketplace, and to what extent they can be systematized. This is something I think still deserving of a future, more systematic study.
And you've just this year published a new book entitled Managing the Wealth of Nation. And I wondered if what you just told us is something that features in that new book as well.
I mean, it does. And I suppose in chapter 5, where I study money as a means of interfering with the economy. So the book is about an intellectual history, a sort of intellectual genealogy of how governments have interfered with markets and the difference that governments could make or temporal authority could make to economic performance. And it's a long-run history running from about the 13th century into the 19th century, trying to deal away with several myths that are still flowing around in the literature about either weak states or uninterested states, states prior to the Industrial Revolution that were not really interested in engaging with or promoting the economy. And looking at purely or primarily from an intellectual history point of view, so I studied mostly texts and books that were written on political economy. I tried to get my hand around what is it that states or governments or temporal authorities could really do in the late Middle Ages and early modern time in terms of interfering positively as well as negatively with the economy. And in that literature, you often find that money is again at the heart. One of the most likely source of government intervention that can, if it's done wisely, actually work quite well. If you manage to keep a sound currency and establish a reliable currency system, and sometimes princes and kings manage to do that. Think of England. After the 16th century, there's no debasement in England. Think about the Netherlands. They have a stable currency from the 16th century onwards. And those are the countries that are the first ones to experience modern economic development. So having a good currency can actually make a great deal of difference. And I simply studied what could pre-modern temporal authorities do with a currency, but other tools as well, in order to promote the economy and create positive economic development. And obviously, it's just a minor point in the book, but the peasant grievances and the peasant war, the evidence kind of points in a certain direction.
Thank you so much for joining us. We really enjoyed speaking to you and hope our listeners enjoy listening as much as we did. Thank you so much.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you for listening to the German Historical Institute London podcast. Follow us on social media and check our website to keep up to date with new episodes.